Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Even as we move past the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, Americans still disagree on what was the fundamental root cause of the conflict. Some say states' rights triggered the split in the Union. Some counter with the economic advantages of slavery, and other arguments point to a widening chasm in culture between the North and the South. But then others, such as writer and Civil War historian Thomas Martin Sabotke, insist the institution of slavery itself was the defining cause at the heart of the war between the states. And it's the central argument of Sabotke's new book, Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory. He says the book was inspired in part by his own experiences as a Civil War reenactor when people would try to convince him that slavery was not the cause of the conflict. So in his book, Sabotke turns to primary sources, the diaries, letters, and publications of people who lived through the war. In this way, he says, he can give these individuals, both famous and unknown, a chance to kind of speak for themselves, to explain why they fought in such a divisive war. Sabotke tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that while there certainly were other issues related to the outcome of the war, most revolved around that one central institution.
All the things you mentioned, economic and political and ideological, were linked to slavery, where slavery could go in our country and where it could not go, whether it would remain an institution protected by U.S. or state laws, or whether it would not, whether the Southern slaveholders would lose some $4 billion in property in any sort of emancipation of the slaves in the Southern slave states. So, you know, these are all things are true. They're, you know, in states' rights was involved, but they all really revolve around that central root of the ownership of one human being by another and the very deep moral question that arises from that.
You also say that even underneath the issue of slavery, of course, were the racial attitudes of the time, something that you argue maybe is the real legacy of the war.
Yeah, it's something that a lot of people in even our time who know a great deal about the Civil War don't always connect. You know, the idea is, okay, slavery's wrong, and as soon as slavery ended in 1865, we can close the Civil War up in a nice, neat box, and we've done our bit. You know, that people are free. But it really misses the point that it wasn't just economic or an abstract battle over states' rights. The South had a social system that was so entrenched, a way of life, that it was very difficult for white Southerners and even many white Northerners who shared their racial attitudes to contemplate emancipation of the slaves for a whole host of reasons. And I want to read something from Stephen F. Hale that he was a commissioner from one of the Southern states that had seceded in the Deep South. And he was writing to Kentucky's governor. And he talks about why everyone has to secede, all the slave states must go and break up the Union. And he talks about the fact that the triumph of this new theory of government, which is Lincoln's election in 1860, destroys the property of the South, lays waste her fields, and inaugurates all the horrors of a San Domingo servile insurrection, consigning her citizens to assassinations and her wives and daughters to pollution and violation to gratify the lust of half-civilized Africans. And then later, he even elaborates on this point, and he says that the slaveholder and the non-slaveholder must ultimately share the same fate, all be degraded to a position of equality with free Negroes, stand side by side with them at the polls, and fraternize in all the social relations of life. And then he talks about race war otherwise. That is pretty direct, and it's awfully candid as to white racial attitudes at the time of the Civil War. That's a common attitude. And servile insurrection, of course, was a 19th century euphemism for an uprising by slaves that would be violent.
I think you also drive home the point of the racial attitudes in this great section of the book where you talk about the 54th Massachusetts, which, of course, is the famous all-black regiment under Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. And you talk about how in that regiment, at times when it was defeated, the black soldiers would try to surrender like their white counterparts, only to be brutally slaughtered by the Confederate soldiers. They weren't even given the ability to surrender as a soldier.
That's right. And that's a way of white Southerners who, to see black people armed in opposition to them, who are trying to kill them at that moment, was so degrading to them. It was so offensive to them that they took these actions. And of course, this happened again and again. It happened at Fort Pillow in Tennessee on a raid by Nathan Bedford Forrest. It happened in what's called the Crater, where they blew up a great landmine to try to break the entrenchments of the Confederates, and the number of white soldiers in one of the Lee's brigades were shouting, kill, of course, it was the N-word plural, killing the black soldiers first and then taking the white soldiers prisoner, as was expected under the rules of war. To be a black soldier, you are doing double duty. You had two different dangers. You had all the dangers that soldiers were heir to, that white soldiers were facing. But if you were captured, your fate was very uncertain. You would be lucky to be captured and returned to slavery. Some were. Many others were not. As a result, not just the 54th, but over 186,000 black men served the United States Army during the Civil War, and they were difference makers. And they fought with an attitude. They had something to prove. And they were very aware of what would happen if they were completely defeated.
Why then, and you explore this in the final chapter of the book, given the evidence, why then 150 years later do so many people not connect race and slavery as the primary motivation behind the Civil War?
Yeah, these things actually do have a sectional basis even today. In April of 2011, CNN polling did a poll where they asked Americans of all backgrounds, you know, just what do you say is the chief cause of the Civil War? And we today, right now, have 42% of Americans saying that it's states' rights. And of course, it kind of sidesteps having to deal with very messy questions of what slavery meant in our nation's history and what it was, and race relations in general. Up to our own day, there is a racial tone to some of the political discourse in the presidential election year we're now in. I'm not suggesting any particular person is a racist, but there is those racial concerns that come to the surface. We're dealing with an American public that is very divorced from academics. Academics have accepted slavery and race as being central to this whole thing since the 1960s and the civil rights years of the last century. But what we have is an American public that is dealing with a 19th century framing and conceptualization of the American Civil War in a 21st century America that's much more diverse racially, ethnically, religiously, and it just doesn't fit anymore. A majority of Americans are ready to have this much more natural and correct view of our war. But there is a large group. The CNN poll did recognize, and they were very careful how they phrased it, but they did indicate that if you were white and you were a Southerner and a conservative, you were almost certain to say that it was states' rights. So you still, there is that sectional Southern element that clings to the lost cause and you know, bravery of their soldiers and fighting against federal power. And of course, there is something in, I think, the Southern temperament, no matter what race, of don't come to our town and tell us how to do things.
Well, why is it not enough to just say it was an issue of states' rights. I mean, couldn't there have been another institution just as central to the Southern way of life, to the Southern economy specifically, like slavery, that didn't involve this question of morality, of owning another human being? I mean, couldn't it have been some other trespass by the federal government that could have triggered a war like this?
I don't think so. I think if you step back a moment and imagine an America with no Africans from Africa in it who become African Americans, that it's hard to imagine a war. What you would have gotten are probably battles – well, I can guarantee you would have gotten a battle over tariffs in the 1860s. And it would be very much like the debt ceiling thing that this country's just gone through. But that would not involve – the slaughter on a battlefield of hundreds of thousands of young men. That's just – it's unimaginable. The tariff will get you partway across the river, but not all the way. And other issues, of course, the industrializing North and the rural South, one of the main reasons that the South was economically on such a different wavelength by the 1860s and felt those changes of modern industrialization kind of hemming them in, it was because of slavery. Even if you didn't own a single slave, the Southern way of life, the social system, had been in place since 1619 or shortly thereafter when the first slaves came to Jamestown. We're talking about a couple of centuries right at the time of the Civil War for Southern Americans who were white and Northern Americans who shared their racial attitudes to develop those attitudes about people of color. Now, there's a lot of – this is racially charged. It's not just a matter of money. And, of course, if it were a matter of having to own someone to make money, the Jim Crow segregation of late 19th century America and 20th century America makes little sense. These African American workers could have been exploited as they were, just like Northern workers were.
I want to talk also about the – you've mentioned it a couple of times – the attitudes of Northerners. Certainly there were abolitionists, but I wonder if today – abolitionists who were agitating for the war to bring back the secessionist states. I wonder, though, if that reputation of the North gets overblown and people forget that many of the people fighting for the North weren't so much fighting – over slavery as they were the preservation of the Union.
That's true. It took many Northerners a long time during the war, probably in the aftermath of the Emancipation Proclamation, to begin to understand that it was slavery that brought on this horrible war. It took a couple of years of war for Northern whites who were fighting to preserve the Union who felt that the South, by seceding, had injured this experiment in democracy. We Americans today forget how young a nation we were. I recall reading about a war correspondent in Virginia during the Peninsula Campaign in 1862 who talked to an old grandpa in a great plantation aristocratic family and his great stories of being bounced on the knee of Thomas Jefferson. None of us could say that today. And we forget how committed Americans in both North and South were to the original democratic experiment of the founders. And they had very different, profound differences about that. The abolitionists who really understood the racial side of this best did amount to only about 4% of the Northern population. But as the war progresses, there is a better understanding that slavery had to go. The Union could not be preserved. You start reading it in letters from soldiers that wouldn't have said that at the beginning of the war. So there is a change. But unfortunately, for a majority of white Northerners, even after the war is over, their racial attitudes are still highly discriminatory. They're very prejudiced. And white supremacy will be something that is commonly accepted throughout the United States for another almost a century.
You make the case that while the Civil War and slavery hold very unique positions in black history, that these are also parts of white Americans' history. and that there's been almost this divorcing between white America and the history and the legacy of the Civil War, or perhaps only what we want to remember. Do you think that by making this a more universal history, we can change some of those attitudes about what actually caused the Civil War?
I think we can over time, and we need to. Our historical memory of the Civil War is malleable. It's changeable. How we look at it at any generation can change. And quite frankly, the way I look at the entire event known as the American Civil War is that this is the pivotal moment when our people have to decide whether we're going to move toward that touchstone ideal that the country was known for and always has been known for all over the world, and that is the principle that all men are born free and equal. Are we going to move toward that principle, or are we going to retreat from it and say, you know, those founders in Philadelphia who founded the United States of America were kidding. It was a nice idea, but it's unworkable. Or are we really going to try to make it work? And I like to think that the victory of the Union in the Civil War to preserve the United States and its democratic experiment and Republican government made it possible for us to move toward that ideal of all men are created equal. And as I'm speaking with you in the audience today, we're still moving toward that ideal. Lincoln would say in a famous speech or in his Galesburg debate with Stephen Douglas in 1858 that this standard of all men are created equal is something to be, you know, constantly looked to and strived for and never quite achieved but approximated. And so he understood the difficulty. Our founders didn't do us a favor in some sense. They really set the human rights bar very high. But it's something that I think all Americans can grasp hold of and say, it's not just the story of African Americans grasping for this equality and an equal start, but it's women and it's working people and immigrants. And it involves just about every one of us in some way or another. And then the American Civil War, 150 years later, can have a very, very deep meaning that will make a lot more sense to us today when we look around and the world has seemingly changed so much, but where this basic ideal is still who we say we're supposed to be as Americans. Are we really that? Do we have a commitment to equality and being born free and equal or not? Maybe we have to ask that 150 years after a war settled that.
Well, Thomas Martin Sabatke, thank you so much for coming in and talking about Across That Dark River.
Thank you.
Pewaukee writer, teacher, and independent Civil War historian Thomas Martin Sabatke is the author of the new book, Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory. It's published by Moving Train Books, which he also founded. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can hear about the origin for Sabatke's book title as supplemental audio at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. Milwaukee native, New York Times science writer, and longtime yoga practitioner Bill Broad is making major waves with a comprehensive scientific study on the risks and rewards of yoga. We'll meet him next on Lake Effect.